history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories that need to be told. There are men and women around us who have done extraordinary things for our sake, and we don't want to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories, and along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these members of our greatest generation. And I did say educated, didn't I? And we are in a school today. Don't do this very often. Usually this program is recorded in the home of a veteran in his most comfortable chair with his loved ones sitting around. And today we've got a big studio audience at Fresno Christian School in Fresno, California. So this is going to be fun today. We're going to see if maybe some of the students have some questions for our guest today as well, Mr. Philip Starr of Selma, California. That's a pretty famous place for one significant reason. Why don't you tell us Selma's claim to fame, Mr. Starr?
What are you talking about?
Well, I know it's the home of Phil Starr. I mean, that's his claim to fame. Don't they say it's the something capital of the world?
The raisin capital of the world. Most of the raisins that we have in the valley are grown and dried within 50 miles of Selma.
Does that mean you saw a few raisins growing up as a boy there?
I've seen a few of them, yes.
Did you ever work out there in those raisin vineyards?
I worked picking grapes one day and found out that if I wanted to starve to death, I could keep picking.
Took you one day, huh?
Yeah, it took me one day to get educated.
Well, we're going to hear about something else you did that not too many people have done, because not everybody could fit in the particular place that you served your time in the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II. We're going to hear about your unique position on bombers in Europe during the war. But growing up in Selma, California, what were those childhood days like?
Same as most everybody.
Same as these high school kids sitting here today in front of you?
Very doubtful. I didn't have a cell phone to play with. We found other things to do, such as play ball. Just everything different from what they do today.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Because everybody I've talked to who was alive then seems to remember something about that day and how the news came to them. Do you remember finding out about Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I remember it. Pearl Harbor was just a big mistake as far as I'm concerned. I mean, anytime you put all your marbles in one glass and think nobody's going to find out about it, and that's what Pearl Harbor was. They had most of the fleet inside the bay. Of course, they didn't know Japan was going to come in and knock them all down.
But for a 17-year-old kid to hear that news,
we would go to the movies. And the newsreel in the movies at that time gave you pictures of all the things that had happened. And it was sad that the Japanese went into concentration camps. We all agree with that. But in my mind, it was protective custody, because you can't believe the amount of people that were very upset about Japan hitting Pearl Harbor and killing all the people they did. So I feel like it was protective custody, but the Japanese probably wouldn't agree with me, but that's all right.
Well, and let's flesh that out a little bit, because I've had a lot of Japanese Americans on this show who served our country during that time, even
that's
while
right.
their families were being held in internment camps.
That's right.
And you're in this part of the country where so many Japanese Americans lived, were productive parts of these communities, a big part of the fabric of these communities. Selma was one of them. A lot of Japanese American farmers in the area. You probably went to school with a fair amount of Japanese-American teenagers.
Several of them. They were very nice people.
Was that kind of strange for you, though, to still be in school and see all of a sudden those classmates of yours who just happened to be Japanese-American were no longer there when they were sent away and they were taken to the camps?
There wasn't that much done with it. I think it was done in Selma anyway, done quietly, and the kids left and that was it. So I don't remember any of that.
And what you were saying when you said that it seemed to you like protective custody was, as much as you were aware of these Japanese American classmates, you were aware of other people in the community who you got the impression would have done them harm if given the opportunity?
You come out of the theater with the newsreel the way it was at that time, yes, I'm sure there would be things happen. But it didn't, so it's fine. What I'm saying is my opinion, and it doesn't mean that it's correct or right, but it's still my opinion.
Absolutely. And you're not saying that you were wanting to do something to them. You're saying that you were aware of that sentiment. So when did it start to occur to you that you might become part of this war that was building intensity around the world?
When my numbers started getting closer in the draft.
Now, all these kids today, I mean, we've got kids in here who are about the same age you were then. They don't have a draft to deal with, but you were aware that they could call you when they wanted you.
Yeah, you got to notice it said, your friends and your neighbors have selected you to be a part of the war.
And how'd you feel about that?
Still mad at my neighbors.
That's how you felt about it. Fair enough.
I was too smart in the third grade, so I had to do it over.
You guys are supposed to laugh at that one.
Yeah. So it put me a little older than some of the kids in my class. I was 19 years old when I was drafted out of high school in my senior year.
And being the oldest of three boys, I imagine that wasn't easy for your folks to see you go.
I can't answer for my folks. They brought me up and patted me on the shoulder, and I left for Monterey.
And at that point, had the thought of serving in airplanes ever crossed your mind?
Well, I had a buddy that I ran around in high school. He said, now we're going to go in and we're going in the Navy. And when the time came, I said, I don't even like water. Why would I want in the Navy? So I took the Air Corps, and it worked out fine for me.
Had you ever been in a plane before?
No. The first plane that I was ever close to was in Laredo, Texas. I was in gunnery school. I was called out to the flight line. The pilot gave me heck before I even started. I had to stand up in the back of an airplane with a 30 caliber machine gun, which I had never fired, shooting at a target being towed by another airplane. So at that moment, I was scared, spitless. I don't know whether I hit anything or not, but it didn't make any difference. They took me.
And you didn't shoot the tow plane down, so that was good. And I want to hear about your 35 missions in the skies over Europe in B-24s and B-17s with the 490th Bomb Group. But I've heard a lot of cool stories from training over the years, too. And I understand you had some interesting scenarios in your training days that got your attention a little bit. Even lightning striking pretty close to where you were?
I went from Fresno to Denver to Laurie Field, did explosive training, so on and so forth there. And then went out to another field, and we went out on bivouac. And I was laying on my stomach with a .30-06 rifle shooting at targets. And it was raining. And all of a sudden, the thunder and lightning. And about 50 feet behind me was a piece of wire, and it set the wire on fire. And that's when I got homesick. I wanted California.
When did you first become aware that there was a position on bombers called the ball turret that you could climb down into?
Well, after training in gunnery school, I came to Salt Lake, and that's where they made up the crews. We had four officers, a ball turret gunner, a top turret gunner, a radio operator waist gunner, tail turret gunner, and I was the ball turret gunner. Well, actually, if you talk to people, they'll say that I didn't fit in the ball turret. Well, I felt very close in there, but it was cozy. But after about five or six missions, whatever, I had figured out how to put another parachute under here and a flak suit and a steel helmet. I wasn't afraid, but I was cautious.
Mr. Starr brought a model of a B-17 here. Now, you flew initially in B-24s, correct?
I did my training in B-24s. I did 17 missions in a B-24. One morning, all of a sudden, the B-24s took off and flew out, and they brought B-17s in. So we did another 3 weeks training in the B-17, and I did my last 18 missions in this. And this is where my home was.
That little tiny ball underneath the fuselage of this bomber, that was his position on all of these missions. Now, does that ball turret stay exactly like that all the time, or is there some hydraulics?
I had... The B-24 was hydraulically operated. The B-17 was electric. I was able to turn this ball 365 degrees and 180 degrees this way. So I had a lot of area to be able to look through a glass about that big around. That's all I could see out of.
How big around?
Oh, maybe 18 inches, maybe. And that, I also had a gun sight.
Who in here is volunteering to jump into one of those ball turrets on the bottom of a bomber?
Oh, it's a great place.
Yeah, he actually volunteered. Wow. It's a great place, huh?
Oh, yeah. You get to look down and see if you can find any German girls or anything.
Uh-huh. What was it like the first time you climbed into one of those?
Scary. Some of the people had training in the ball turret. I had an amount of training to get in it and learn on my own.
Had you ever been overseas before?
No. We trained in Mountain Home, Idaho. We left Mountain Home in April for Lincoln, Nebraska. The weather closed in on us. We found a hole in a cloud and dropped into the Twin Cities and stayed there a week and then went on to Nebraska, got the Norden bomb site. The bombardiers were able to use this bomb site to be able to bomb a target. We got that. We'd already had our weapons issued to us. I had a .45. We went from Lincoln to Florida, from Florida to Trinidad. On the way from Trinidad to Belém, South America, I had a fair-weather pilot. We had clouds that had no ceiling and no bottoms to them, and he got to circling, and all of a sudden the navigator came on and, with a few choice words, told the pilot that he was lost and didn't care to get a fix, and the radio operator got a fix on the field, and we landed on a single airstrip in the Amazon Basin, and I've never really been able to find it, but they called it Lindbergh Field. It had 100 ground crewmen there for dummies like us, and 200 Navy with two blimps. And this was not too far from the mouth of the Amazon River. So when we finally got straightened out there, and we went to Belém and then to Africa and stayed in Africa a day or two. And then we had to fly out away from certain areas because the Germans had Ju-88s, which was a twin-engine attack bomber. And we were supposed to be, all of us, in our turrets and what have you, and watching for fighters, and all of a sudden we heard a noise, and it was another airplane went over the top of us, and the pilot was very upset because we were all asleep. But we made it to England. We have the bad distinction of, I said I had a fair weather pilot, but the airplane we went overseas in had 100 hours on it. And the first day they took off to go get some armor plating or whatever, somebody pulled the landing gear off from under it too soon. It mushed in the ground and burned up. That's a brand new airplane. But I wasn't there. I was in town.
So you get a different airplane that's probably not as new, right?
They brought us another one in, you know. And he and the co-pilot disappeared for half a dozen missions or so. The co-pilot never came back. Found out later that he didn't know how to land an airplane even. So I was glad he was gone.
Let me ask you on that incident, you said you were in town, not on it, when the plane you'd come over on had that bad landing. Was anyone hurt or killed in that?
No.
The plane burnt up, but they all survived.
The plane mushed in. The plane had a putt-putt hydraulic motor to keep the hydraulics up on the plane, because everything in the plane was hydraulic. The putt-putt caught on fire, and I feel like we were there so soon they didn't have the fire department there yet, but it burned up and they all got out.
So this is 1944. You've just turned 20 years old. You end up at a base in England. It's a long way from home.
A long way from home.
Were you nervous before that first mission?
I don't remember things like that. I'm afraid that we had a job to do and fear wasn't one of our problems. We just did what we were told.
How would you articulate what your job was from start to finish on one of these bombing missions?
Okay, the ball turret, I had access to be able to shoot a fighter from here or a circle. Now, something that you might be interested in, if you had a ball turret, there was stops on the ball turret. I couldn't go up high enough to shoot the props off the airplane. If you were in the waist, you couldn't go out far enough to take the wing or the tail off. So everything was safe as far as that's concerned.
So you weren't going to shoot yourself down, but the enemy was certainly trying to. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos relating to Mr. Starr's story, including the piece of flak he's held on to for 73 years. How close did that come to hitting him? Find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.